We're going to continue on in our series in Ruth. I'm not sure if you've ever watched people from different sports teams, but at the beginning of the season, what are they like? You know, if you interview, especially not just sports teams, but like wrestlers or boxers or that, if they're interviewed before the fight, it's, I'm the best, I'm taking that guy, he's going down, the team. We're the best team, we're going to win, we're the team to beat, we've got it made. They'll profess that, but yet only time will tell whether they possess the trophy in the end. Will they possess the trophy and be able to hold it over their heads in the end? Did you ever have an opportunity to see a large Billy Graham crusade? It was amazing. They were amazing, actually, to watch and see all those people singing and listening to the gospel message. Thousands of people. Then at the closing of the service, Billy Graham would give an altar call. He'd give the invitation and ask people who wanted to receive Jesus to come forward to receive Jesus. And they would come forward by the hundreds. I mean, the stadiums were packed full. That's a lot of people. That's a few more people than we have on a Sunday morning. But they would come forward, and they would come, and they would profess their faith in Jesus Christ. So what would happen? What happens to all those people that profess their faith? Well, I don't know. But the truth is, only time tells whether they just professed their faith or eventually they took possession of their faith. They possessed a solid faith in Jesus. As we continue today to look at the book of Ruth, we're going to look at that question. Do we just profess a faith, or are we people who possess the faith? Jesus states in Matthew 20, chapter 25, that the nations will be called before him, and he will separate the sheep from the goats. In other words, there are two distinct different people there. And while Matthew 7:21 reveals Jesus saying, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. In other words, some are mere just professors of faith. Oh yes, I can say, Lord, Lord, but do they possess the faith? There's obviously a distinction. And as we continue to look at Naomi and Orpah and Ruth today, we will see that there are those who possess a sincere faith and those who only merely profess a faith. Last week we looked at the first seven verses in the book of Ruth. Elimelech tried to escape death in Judah because there was a famine there. So he thought, there's food in Moab, we'll go there. So he takes his two sons and his wife down to Moab. Unfortunately, it's not long after they get there and Elimelech dies. His two sons marry Moabite women, and they live for about 10 years before they too die. This left Naomi alone in a foreign land with no male to protect her and her family on the verge of extinction. All seems to be lost. It seems hopeless and the situation devastating to them. We're so blessed as people. When we come to the end of our rope, like Naomi is there, God shows up. He's always there for us. Naomi hears that God has come to the aid of those in Judah, and the famine is over. And because there's a glimmer of hope, Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth make the choice to get back on the right track and start to head back to Judah. Start to go back to where the promised land is. Start to go back to their inheritance, or Naomi's inheritance, anyhow. It's great to know that God continually tries to get our attention when we get off track. Elimelech had taken his family off track, and yet God was still there trying to get their attention. You need to come back. You need to come back. See, no, Naomi is not just a professor of faith. Naomi possesses her faith. Because when it's all looking hopeless, when everything is devastating and there looks like there's nothing left in the world, she hears God say, there's food, there's bread for you in the land of Judah. The famine's over. You need to come back. How do I know she's a possessor of the faith? Because if she was just a professor of the faith, and where she was in her situation, she had left, they'd come to Moab, she had lost her husband, lost her two sons, she has nothing left, she would have said, look, why am I going to go back to Judah? What is the point? God, you didn't take care of me while I was here. My husband's gone, my two sons are gone. What's the use? You let me down. I'm not going back. But Ruth chapter 1, verses 6 to 7, and we read these last week. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people to provide food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take her back to the land of Judah. Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth headed out on the 50-mile trek back to Judah. I mean, that's a step of faith in itself. Three young ladies, well, not all young, but three ladies take off from Moab to travel 50 miles in the wilderness by themselves. No male protection. Doesn't sound like a good thing. Doesn't sound like a good thing today, never mind back in the wilderness. So they head off in the wilderness. No, Naomi decides to share how she feels after they've headed off a little while. She wants to share with Orpah and Ruth what it would be like for them to come back to Judah. Ruth chapter 1, verse 8, and the first half of verse 9, we read, then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you, as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. See, Naomi reasons with the girls as to why they should turn back. She tells them that they should go back to their mother's home. If you go back to Moab, you probably will be able to find a nice Moabite man to marry, and he will take care of you. I mean, really, think about it. You know no one in Judah, but you know the culture, the gods, and the people of Moab. You should go back to Moab. It will be a lot easier there for you than coming to Judah with me. You should go back. Doesn't that sound familiar? It'll be easier. That's the easier way. That's easy street. You would abandon your faith you have professed to take the easier way. How often does Satan say that to us, especially to new believers? There's an easier way. Do you think you're doing? Do you really think you can handle this? It's way easier out there. It's way easier just to cheat on your income tax than to pay your income tax and stand righteous. It's way easier just to walk in the things of the world than to try and maintain that book. Man, can you imagine trying to maintain all this? It's way easier just to get on with life the way it was. Easy street. That is the world, what the world will tell us. The world's wisdom. Many give up on their profession of faith because the road is not easy and inviting as the one they've chosen. Isn't that what Jesus states when he said in Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it, but small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Satan tries to sidetrack people, to lure them to easy street. He not only does that when we first profess our faith, but he'll do it through trials and struggles along our journey. Proverbs 14, verse 12 declares, "There's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end, it leads to death." The easier way may seem right sometimes, or maybe even most of the time, but it leads to death. It leads us to a place where we don't really want to be. Short-term gain can bring long-term pain. You know, we think it's easy now, and it might be easy. It might be easy for a week or a month or a few years, but eventually there'll be long-term pain. Satan doesn't want us to become possessors of our faith. He wants us to merely just be professors and give up. At this point, both Orpah and Ruth are not swayed by the worldly wisdom. As we read in the last half of verse 9 and verse 10, "Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud, and she said to her, 'We will go back with you to your people.'" So the girls are going to continue on. There's another test. See if they really possess their faith or not. Naomi continues to share her concerns in verses 11 to 13. "But Naomi said, 'Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have more sons? Would you come, who would become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old and have to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait for them till they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." Naomi gets more personal and wants the girls to think about what life would really be like in Judah. She declares, in the eyes of the world, how logically impossible it is for the girls to make it in Judah. "I mean, really," she says, "is it possible for me to get married? I'm old. I'm in the seniors. I'm old. I'm not getting married again. And even if I do go to Judah and I find a man that wants to marry me, what's the chances of me having children? I mean, having two sons. And do you know how old you'll be before they'll marry you? Are you really going to wait?" And that might happen, as far-fetched as that is. It could happen. It could happen. But something that will not happen is the fact that if you come to Judah with me, the Jewish men there will not marry you. They will not intermarry with the Moabite women. So if you come to Judah, it's going to be a lonely, hard life. In fact, it's so hard, she says, that my life is bitter, and the Lord's hand is against me. So if you come with me, do you want to be where the Lord is against me? Naomi declares that it's just logically impossible for them to come. Don't we hear that a lot as well? It can't possibly work. How is this newfound faith of yours going to work? I mean, really, think about it. You're on shift work. You can't even make it. You're going to miss 4 Sundays a month. How can that ever work? The church won't keep you there. They won't have anything to do with it. Oh, you're divorced. The church won't have you if you're divorced. Oh, but you've got this problem and you've got that problem. It won't work. It's impossible. You might as well give up now. Isn't that what Satan says? Aren't those the things that Satan says? It won't work. It's impossible. Logically, it's impossible. And then as we go along our journey, doesn't Satan tell us the same thing? God asks us to do something. God asks us to share with our neighbor. And Satan, what does he say? No, don't share with Joe. He will never believe. In fact, he'll tear you apart. Don't share with Joe. Don't invite him to church. Again, Satan doesn't want us to move from just professing our faith to actually possessing it. And at this point, Orpah is convinced that it won't work out in Judah. And she wants to take the easier road back. So we read in verse 14, At this they wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. This is the point where Ruth has moved from just professing her faith to possessing it. See, Ruth clung to her mother-in-law. The Hebrew word there for clung, which is translated, is the same word, Hebrew word, used in Genesis 2:24, which is translated united or cleave. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united or cleave to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The word clung means to fasten oneself to an object. It is a picture of real affection and utmost loyalty. It means to like super glue to another one, to one another. It is to forsake everything in the past and stick yourself completely to something else. Isn't that what Ruth has done? She's forsaking her gods, her people, her land, and saying, I'm going with you, Naomi. Yet Naomi tries one last time to get Ruth to go back as well. In verse 15, we read, look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. It's the statement, everybody else is doing it. Everybody else is going back. Everybody else, I mean, think about it. What are your classmates doing? How many of them go to church? Are you really going to do that? You should just go back with your classmates and do what everybody else is doing. I mean, what are you doing on Sunday? You're going to church? Oh, everybody's going to the lake. Oh, maybe we should all go to the lake. Peer pressure. But Ruth is not sidetracked by easy street, the logically impossible, or peer pressure. She possesses her faith. How much does Ruth possess her faith? How is she super glued to Naomi and her faith? Ruth is going with Naomi to Judah, no matter what it costs her. Listen to verses 16 and 17. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. How committed is Ruth? She's geographically committed. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. If you're going to Judah, I'm going there. Even though Moab's my home and that's where I was raised, I will go. I'm geographically committed. Where the Lord wants me, I will go. She's ethnically committed. Your people will be my people. I know I was raised with the Moabites, but now I will walk with your people, Ruth. Where your people are, I will be with God's people. I will possess the faith. I will walk with God's people. She's theologically committed. Your God will be my God. I mean, there's gods in Moab, and I used to serve them, but now I will cling to your God, and I will serve your God and your God only. And she's permanently committed. Where you die, I will die. So what Ruth is saying is that it doesn't matter about anything else. I'm in it for the long haul. I'm possessing my faith. I'm there until I die. I'm not coming back in 2 years or 10 years or saying that it got too hard in Judah and I'm leaving and coming back. I'm permanently committed. In verse 18, Naomi finally realizes. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. We need to be possessors of our faith. We need to be possessors. Orpah had a lot of emotion. She cried and said, no, I'm going to go with you. After the worldly wisdom, she was still on the way. I'll profess this faith. I'm going. And she cried, but it didn't last. She didn't possess the faith. It didn't stand the test. And we realize from Naomi that if we possess our faith, we will desire the things of God, no matter what the cost is. And we will still desire them, no matter if we're sidetracked or things look hopeless. We will still be looking for God in the midst of the situation. He's the foundation. He's the cornerstone. Ruth shows us that it really means to possess our faith. It really means that we need to be all in. It's all or nothing, geographically, ethnically, theologically, permanently. It's all or nothing, and it's going to cost us a lot, but we're in. And that's what it means to possess our faith. Are we professors of our faith and merely say, yeah, I believe in Jesus, and that's the end of it? Or are we possessors of our faith? Are we those who are all in, no matter what the cost? If we are professors of our faith only, what we need to do to move forward is to become real possessors of our faith. We need to ask and hear Jesus saying, walk with me, talk with me, I'm here. I'll bring you to that place you want to be. Jesus never leaves us. He's always going to give us a light. The truth is, I believe you folks are possessors of your faith because I see your lives. I know where you're at. We need to continue to walk on with Jesus to the end. Never give up.